Good evening, everyone. Tonight's talk is called The Harmless Path. In the late 1940s, the spiritual head of one of India's main religious institutions began a search to find his successor. At the same time, certain articles began appearing in a variety of newspapers. The articles concerned a yogi, a Hindu holy man, who was practicing austerities on the banks of the river Narmada, which flow through central India. What had captured media interest was a photograph taken of the yogi by big game hunters who happened to be passing. The photo showed him sitting on the bank of the river, deep in meditation, surrounded by crocodiles, some of whom were lying just a few yards away. The river there was full of them, and every morning and evening they would come and lie on the sand. Neither the man nor the crocodiles seemed in any way troubled by each other's presence. The yogi's countenance was serene. Some feat. How could it be done? The newspapers speculated. Did the yogi have some mysterious psychic powers, or was the photograph a fraud? To the head of the religious institution, it was clear. Though completely at the mercy of his surroundings and all its apparent dangers, the holy man was able to live in perfect harmony with it. Serenity and freedom from harm were his, despite the vulnerability of his situation. It's tempting to think that the yogi was doing something quite miraculous in being able to remain so serene in such a dangerous situation. However, it's perhaps more accurate to state that the crocodile's acceptance of him wasn't because of something he did. Rather, it was because of what he wasn't doing that they remained untroubled. He was actually displaying the quintessence of the spiritual life. He was at peace, enjoying total freedom and utterly harmless both to himself and others. It seemed he understood how the world works. And, as Alan once wrote, if there is understanding, there is no fear. There is no security except that of total freedom. Tonight's talk will look at the Buddha's Noble Eightfold Path and how, by employing it in daily life, we too can come to this deep understanding and enjoy the security of total freedom. Though the location may not be quite so exotic, here in Wiltshire we have our own brand of crocodiles. Recently, a man passed a house protected by 5 or 6 very fierce, large and angry guard dogs. The dogs were loose and were separated from the road only by a 4-foot wall. Barking, snarling, and baring their teeth, the dogs amply demonstrated the ease with which they could jump over the wall. The man was frightened and incensed by what he thought was intimidation on the part of the owners. Just the other day, a lady in a Fiesta drove into the box junction at the bottom of Mason's Lane, just as a lorry was coming the other way. Obviously embarrassed and flustered, she acknowledged her mistake and moved her car in such a way as to let the lorry pass. Although this only took a few moments, it was long enough to infuriate the lorry driver. Passing by, he wound down his window, let out a volley of abuse, and made an obscene gesture with his hand. The lady was visibly upset. I'm sure we all endure incidents like this from time to time. It's not just road rage or canine intimidation we have to watch out for, however. There seem to be potential threats to our welfare at every level of life. We have war and terrorism at one end of the scale, and conflict in our personal relationships at the other. There's also the ever-looming threat of economic or environmental catastrophe, not to mention burglary, fraud, street violence, and now guns in schools. Deep down, we all want much the same thing. The freedom to live peacefully and to follow our chosen paths in life without intimidation or fear for our well-being. We act in ways that we believe minimize any potential risk and ensure our continued survival. At home, we might create a sense of security with high walls, security cameras, or ferocious guard dogs. On the streets, we might learn some form of self-defense or carry personal alarms. At work, even at school, in order to cope with the harsh realities of life, we develop a thick skin, adopt a harder attitude, and give as good as we get. We learn how to puff ourselves up, snarl, and bite back. We learn the art of retaliation in word and deed, and look for opportunities to launch the preemptive strike, get them before they get you. There's our need for psychological security too, and many find solace through identification with a group or a set of ideas. Having a shared description of the world through politics, religion, or even football can provide a sense of security. It's safety in numbers, being lost in the crowd. But, as one wise man put it, if an individual has capacity, then belief becomes a potent thing in his hands, a weapon more dangerous than a gun. And therein lies the rub. For, more often than not, actions brought about to solve conflicts simply exacerbate them. Actions born of fear seem only to breed more fear. Hence there is retaliation and the inevitable escalation as both sides in any dispute raise the ante again and again. Unfortunately, most of us can't see this very clearly. We tend to see the origin of our fear as external to us and believe that we must manipulate the outside world in order to regain our peace of mind. Buddhism, in contrast, says that if you want peace of mind, then don't act out of fear, or anger, or hatred, or indeed any other unwholesome state. The Buddhist perspective is that acts of violence of whatever kind merely breed more violence. Instead, the Buddha recommended an entirely different approach. Hate is not overcome by hate, he said. Hate is overcome by love. Clearly not a view endorsed by everyone. But in realizing the futility of conflict as a way to resolve conflict, it transpires that the harmless approach is the only possible alternative. Of course, we're not saints, and all too often, good intentions give way to more powerful negative habitual responses. Fortunately, the Buddha laid down a system of personal development whereby, if we wish, we can overcome all such difficulties. It's a practical training in wisdom that can transform our entire relationship with life. Consider this quotation from Jackie Jones, co-founder of the House of Inner Tranquility. When you feel, you must protect yourself from that out there. Then you are at the mercy of it. It can get you. It's only when you are willing to let that thing come in and throw you about inside that you are safe. What Jackie's statement indicates is a willingness to be completely open and vulnerable to life, to allow our experiences to teach us exactly how life works rather than reacting blindly. This isn't easy, as it means learning to accept painful and unpleasant events when they occur, and to observe the whole process with dispassion and equanimity. The Buddha's teaching on karma and vipaka, or action and result, indicates that whatever we experience by way of pleasure or pain is actually due to our own past actions. How we react now when confronted with these resultants determines what we can expect to experience in the future. To illustrate this, consider someone suffering from arachnophobia. I once witnessed a young woman become utterly paralyzed with fear just being told there was a spider in the same room. She was a helpless wreck until somebody got rid of it. Undoubtedly, the fear she felt was real. But was there really any threat? As Jackie said, when you feel you must protect yourself from that out there, then you are at the mercy of it. But what she reacted to wasn't the spider at all. Rather, it was the intense and unpleasant nature of the feelings and perceptions she experienced upon being told of the spider's presence. According to the law of karma, the resultant feelings and perceptions were painful because of having reacted negatively in similar situations in the past. Any violence towards the spider is completely misplaced, but the effect will be to create increased resistance in the future. It's a catch-22 situation where every negative, blind reaction is the very force that perpetuates the conflict indefinitely. If anyone faced with similar situations wishes to learn how to cut through this vicious cycle, they would be well to follow Jackie's advice and be willing to let that thing come in and throw you about inside. In doing so, we stop resisting blindly and instead pay attention to what is actually happening. By remaining open and vulnerable, we create an opportunity to view the whole process for ourselves, and in doing so, we can dissolve our ignorance and come to a true understanding of it. Anyone who has reached the point where they wish to take responsibility in this way will find no finer system of training than the Buddha's Noble Eightfold Path. In Buddhism, to be of the opinion that actions have results is to hold right view, the first factor in the Eightfold Path. Our views are the framework by which we interpret our world. Consequently, they condition our actions and have a far-reaching influence. To adopt a belief in karma is to fall in line with the laws that govern our material and spiritual welfare in the mundane world. We then have a realistic and pragmatic description of the way the world works, which in turn will have a bearing on the way we think and act. Right thought, the second factor in the path, is sometimes called right intention or right aspiration. In essence, it's the aim of developing renunciation, loving kindness, and harmlessness, and abandoning their opposites of greed, ill will, and cruelty. Right thought provides a crucial link between our views and the actions we perform. For instance, right view states that acting in cruel and violent ways is conducive only of pain to us and others. This understanding naturally evokes an intention to be harmless and to develop a compassionate attitude. Together, right view and right thought provide the impetus for entering the training. At this stage, they make sense intellectually, but the real test is to put the training into practice in our daily lives. Our daily lives are filled with endless action. We perform thousands of minute actions every day that are chemically active and will therefore influence our future. Karma is volitional mental action, which, based on the views we hold, attempts to bring all our various desires to life. It is these underlying motives, our desires, that give the ethical quality to the action, and hence the result. Put simply, selfish actions based in greed, ill will, or cruelty will bring suffering, while selfless actions like renunciation, loving kindness, and harmlessness are conducive to happiness. It's critical to understand that it's this very life, our everyday experiences, to which the training refers. It's here that we reap the rewards of past action, perform both wholesome and unwholesome ethical deeds in speech and bodily action, and in so doing, create our own future. If we want to overcome our blind reactions and learn how to respond adequately to life situations to ensure a happy future, there's simply nowhere else to do it. Hence, the Buddha devoted three factors of the Noble Eightfold Path to just this, namely, right speech, right action, and right livelihood. To help guide us, he laid down the five precepts as a practical framework. These are to abstain from killing and harming, from stealing, from sexual misconduct, from all forms of wrong speech, and from intoxicants. By abiding by these rules of training, we are naturally brought face to face with the reality of our actions and the motives behind them. As we become more conscious of what leads to harmlessness and what does not, we may well begin to make changes. At work, for instance, we may choose to stop tearing down the reputation of our colleagues and instead practice patience and forbearance, developing friendly and affectionate speech instead. We find that people feel they can confide in us without fear, and we become someone to be trusted. Alternatively, we may learn to accept the painful feelings associated with blame and restrain the urge to angrily justify ourselves. The result is that colleagues can now approach us with problems without having to put up their guard. Of course, it would be impossible to give examples of all the painful situations we are likely to encounter in the daily round. However, the key to success in becoming harmless is common in all cases. Each of us will need to develop the capacity to discriminate accurately what goes on in our mind and body, as well as the external world. In addition, we will also need to develop a balanced, loving, an equanimous mind that is able to deal comfortably with the painful experiences when they arise. Of course, nothing much is going to happen without putting forth energy, but it needs to be a balanced approach that can be sustained over the long term. The book states that right effort is fourfold: to avoid the arising of unwholesome states, to abandon those unwholesome states already arisen, to develop wholesome states, and to maintain wholesome states already arisen. To do this, we need to develop mindfulness, to clearly comprehend what's actually going on in thought, speech, and action as our day unfolds. We need to investigate our experience and observe how all these wholesome and unwholesome states arise, how long they last, and what effects they have both on us and others. This is a skill that needs deliberate development, and hence the reason for formal seated meditation. We voluntarily set ourselves apart from the mad whirl of life for half an hour or an hour a day or for a week on retreat. Thus separated, we have the time and space to develop mindfulness and concentration. We work at overcoming the hindrances, and in doing so, come to understand through our own experience the many and varied ways we blindly react to life with craving and hatred. We also actively encourage positive states like loving kindness, compassion, sympathetic joy and equanimity, and in doing so, develop a soft, accepting tone to the mind that can transform daily life. The importance in terms of living a harmless life of these last two path factors of right mindfulness and right concentration cannot be underestimated. The Buddha gave the following illustration. There are two jugglers performing acrobatic feats on a bamboo pole. One juggler suggests that to ensure their safety, each should protect and guard the other. But the other replies that it would be better for each to protect and guard himself. Thus, self-protected and self-guarded, they would be able to perform their feats safely. The Buddha went on, just as the juggler says, I shall protect myself. In that way, the foundations of mindfulness should be practiced. Just as the juggler says, I shall protect others. In that way, the foundations of mindfulness should be practiced. Protecting oneself, one protects others. Protecting others, one protects oneself. The Buddha continued, and how does one, in protecting oneself, protect others? By the repeated and frequent practice of meditation. And how does one, in protecting others, protect oneself? By patience and forbearance, by a non-violent and harmless life, by loving kindness and compassion. As a consequence of following this harmless path, our lives become more peaceful, and the unwelcome conflicts become more manageable and even less frequent. It seems we really are learning to live in harmony with the crocodiles all around us. But so far, this more peaceful outlook has depended on developing skills in mind control. In developing right effort, we have actively sought to abandon unwholesome states of mind and develop their opposites. This is good. This is very good, but it's still not enough. Skills can get rusty, and our negative tendencies are still latent within us and can re-emerge at any time. To truly be said to be harmless, we need to dig up and destroy the very roots of blind reaction. To do this, we need to continue to follow the Noble Eightfold Path. Now, instead of relating to the mundane world, each factor is developed with a view to understanding life at the level of ultimate reality. With a balanced, concentrated, and open mind established through walking the mundane path, we use vipassana, or insight meditation, to uncover the deepest truths of all. We repeatedly observe the three marks of impermanence, unsatisfactoriness, and non-self in everything we experience, and what we find leads to a fundamental transformation. The more deeply we look into mind and body, the more it becomes apparent that there is nothing solid or lasting to be found anywhere. We can see nothing more than a series of momentary events arising and passing away, insubstantial, ephemeral, no more real than bubbles popping on the surface of water. With a growing detachment and ever-increasing clarity, we see that this event could only happen because of that event, which itself was just as fleeting and no more real. We realize with the searing jolt of insight that I did not do it. There was no doer, no owner of that experience at all, only conditioned and conditioning phenomena. It is this level of insight that breaks down the most fundamental ignorance concerning the nature of reality. We assume that I exist behind all actions of body, speech, and mind, a permanent observer running parallel to events and dictating, controlling, comparing, and judging them. But as the meditation deepens, it becomes ever more clear that dictating, controlling, comparing, and judging are themselves nothing but ephemeral, momentary events that arise due to conditions and then pass away. They too are impermanent, insubstantial, and impersonal, and cannot be the self. Taken to its inevitable conclusion, insight reveals the deepest understanding of all, that there is no controller behind events, there are just events, arising and passing in an endless series. There is no self, was no self, could never be a self. Realization dawns, the lights are on, but no one's home. The law of karma depends on a view of self as its basic condition. When that is taken away, so too is the most fundamental conflict of human existence. The vicious cycle of action and result is severed, and the blind reactions of craving and hatred are destroyed forever. We need to be clear here that freedom comes from complete understanding of the entire process of action and result. Any attempt to solve the problem is still action caught up with the idea, I am doing this. Therefore, the duality remains, and with it, the potential for all the conflicts in the world. But when wisdom arises, ignorance is immediately dispelled, and all the problems it creates are destroyed. As the Buddha said, he who sees me sees the Dhamma. He who sees the Dhamma sees me. The enlightened man or woman is truly harmless. Having walked the Buddha's Noble Eightfold Path to its completion, they have become ennobled, saintly. Because this basic conflict has been resolved and all duality ceases, the enlightened being merges effortlessly with life. Allen once wrote, an enlightened man is trackless, like a bird in the sky. There is no way he can be discovered. There is no way he can be caught in the traps of man. Whilst being in the world, he is at the same time beyond it. Perhaps the central message of this talk is, if we want the world to be harmless, then that is how we need to behave. Understanding is the first and last step in walking the Buddha's Noble Eightfold Path. The teaching shows us the way to peace through being open, vulnerable, and willing to learn from our experiences. The wisdom developed in this way leads inexorably to total freedom and utter harmlessness. Sariputta, the Buddha's chief disciple, put it like this. If others comport themselves in undesirable, disagreeable, and unpleasant ways towards a monk, and he receives blow from their hands, and from clods of earth, and from sticks and weapons, he comprehends thus. Unsluggish energy shall come to be stirred up by me, unmuddled mindfulness set up, the body tranquilized, impassible, the mind composed and one-pointed. Now, willingly, let blows from hands affect this body, let blows from clods of earth affect it, let blows from sticks and from weapons affect it, for this teaching of the awakened ones is being done. Thank you.